Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Guilty as charged in a big Wall Street insider trading case, big tax breaks for big oil, and a bad news, good news economic report. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, today, the 11th of May. Good as always to have you with us. Federal prosecutors threw a rare shutout against Wall Street today. A jury in Manhattan has convicted the billionaire hedge fund manager Rajaratnam on all 14 counts of securities fraud and conspiracy. In simpler terms, insider trading. Rajaratnam was accused of making more than $60 million by trading with privileged information. In simpler terms, illegally. Wasn't all that long ago that powerful Wall Street types like Rajaratnam brushed off threats from the Justice Department and the SEC, but apparently no more. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
We all know from watching cop movies that it's great to catch a criminal before he gets away, but it's even better to catch him in the act. Today's conviction of Raj Rajaratnam shows that the government's use of wiretaps has launched it beyond small-time players in the stock market.
They get a lot of small fish in the kind of traditional insider trading context. And here, with wiretap information, they were able to flip cooperators to testify against the person at the very top of the hierarchy.
That's Tony Berkow. He's a former federal prosecutor who now teaches at New York University's law school. But wiretaps aren't the only thing that's changed. A few years back, the SEC created a kind of SWAT team to examine insider trading. It also beefed up with a herd of aggressive former prosecutors. Most importantly, the SEC, the Department of Justice, and the FBI worked together to infiltrate Rajaratnam's hedge fund. Here's Berkow again.
Kind of spreads like a web, kind of like a social network in a lot of ways. It's like who's talking to who knows who.
Hedge fund managers will have to rethink who they trust, says Bill Currier. He used to be with the SEC, and now he's at law firm White & Case.
The message that the U.S. Attorney's Office and the SEC want to be received by this verdict is beware if you're intent on engaging in this activity, you may be talking to someone who's wearing a wire and is cooperating with the authorities.
Rajaratnam has vowed to appeal his conviction, but in the meantime, he's wearing a government wire of his own, an electronic monitoring device. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
So with Rajaratnam guilty, pending, as Heidi said, appeal, what's next? To talk about all of that, we've turned to Jacob Frankel. He used to be a lawyer with the Securities and Exchange Commission. He's in private practice now. Mr. Frankel, welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here.
As we just heard Heidi talking about, this was kind of an all-hands-on-deck effort for federal prosecutors in this case. Can we now expect more prosecutions along these lines?
No question about it. And in fact, I believe where the government may have had some question marks by the names of some other senior corporate hedge fund officials on Wall Street, I think they've quickly moved those to a green check mark with the confidence that they will now move forward with those prosecutions.
So you've been inside the corridors of power at the SEC as an enforcement lawyer, as a federal prosecutor. Explain for me, if you could, their mindset now as they start to plot more prosecutions. How are they going to do it? What are they going to go after? And how are we going to know when things are changing in terms of the government actually regulating effectively?
Well, this is, in some respects, a regulation by enforcement, because insider trading falls within the general anti-fraud provision of the federal securities laws. But we are already seeing a change in Wall Street to the extent that firms are paying closer attention to the counterparties with whom their analysts, their traders are speaking. From an enforcement perspective, when the government wins a case such as this, 14 for 14 counts, an overwhelming verdict, it creates a sense of empowerment, the belief that even the difficult cases, the most well-defended, well-funded defenses can still result in a victory. And the SEC and the Department of Justice are very confident that they can continue their aggressive approach and mandate.
A lot of people are going to read or hear about this case. They're going to hear the headline that says, big Wall Street guy was convicted today, and they're going to say, aha, I knew those so-and-sos were cheating me. You know?
No question about that. Will this make a difference to the small investor? No. The small investor right now is so skeptical of Wall Street. Will it end insider trading? No. But it certainly sends a compelling message that the government views no one on Wall Street as untouchable.
So this is an admittedly cynical viewpoint, but what are the odds that a lot of the traders and a lot of the people on Wall Street today are saying, wow, okay, we better not say any of this stuff on the cell phones, and we better not send any emails, and not substantively changing behavior?
There is certainly an element, particularly those who are predisposed to violate the law and gain access to information that they should not be using, to try to find other ways to circumvent the ability of the government or others to track what they do. And in fact, that's why the investigative techniques in this case were so powerful. But just as there are hedge fund and other professionals who may be trying to find other ways to exchange information out of sight, there are also many Wall Street professionals who are applauding when they see people who are gaming the system convicted for doing so.
Jacob Frankel used to be a federal prosecutor and an enforcement lawyer at the SEC. He's a partner now at Shulman & Rogers. Mr. Frankel, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
I don't know what kind of trading it was today, inside or outside, but there was a whole lot of selling on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Getting a hip replacement is a painful and increasingly common procedure. So apparently is having a problem with that new hip after you own it. The Food and Drug Administration is starting to pay more attention to defects in medical devices like those hip replacements after they've been approved for sale. And that has more than a dozen manufacturers under the microscope. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
Imagine you get an all-metal hip replacement. The parts start rubbing together, releasing metal particles into your bloodstream. The FDA is hearing more and more complaints like this, so it's ordered more than 20 metal hip manufacturers to study the problem and report back.
It is really unusual.
That's healthcare consultant Jerry Katz. He says the hip replacement studies are unusual because the FDA normally does its toughest scrutiny of a product before it's approved for use. At that point, the device is expected to work. But that's not always the case. Look at pacemakers, says Katz.
Failure, recall, and that's a big deal.
Katz expects the FDA to tackle the pacemaker problems next. One of the agency's lead scientists, Dr. William Maisel, won't confirm that, but he says the FDA will soon require tracking devices on products like pacemakers.
We'll be able to very specifically identify the model, the lot number, the manufacturing plant where a device was made.
Medical device manufacturers aren't too enthusiastic about the additional scrutiny. David Nexon heads the trade association, AdvaMed.
And if there's an issue, FDA needs to look at it. Manufacturers understand that and support it. But, you don't want regulations that's unnecessary or inappropriate, overly burdensome.
The FDA's Maisel doesn't want to limit access to products consumers need and are already using. But for now, the agency appears to be leaning toward more research, even after approval. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Nothing gets corporate officers a summons to Washington faster than a mind-bending profit report, which is how it's going to come to pass tomorrow that oil company executives are going to be in the witness chairs at a hearing of the Senate Finance Committee. Senators want to know exactly why, in the face of tens of billions of dollars in quarterly profits, big oil ought to be getting billions in tax breaks. Marketplace's Scott Tong is here with a preview of that hearing. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Kai.
So let's talk about these tax breaks. Who specifically is targeted in this bill?
The bill doesn't actually name any companies, but it applies to certain producers with certain revenues who traffic in a certain number of barrels. And guess what? Only the five biggest multinational oil companies meet the criteria. ExxonMobil, BP, Chevron, Conoco, Shell. What a coincidence. I spoke today to analyst Kevin Book at Clearview Energy Partners, and he says with gas prices at $4, somebody has to pay a political price.
The question of who is going to pay when prices are high has four answers. You can blame the president, the Fed, the speculators or the oil industry, and tomorrow is the oil industry's day.
Now, Kai, as factors, you also have Asian demand, which is rising, OPEC cutting production. I mean, it's complicated, gas prices, but if you want nuance, a congressional scolding is not the place to go.
So let's go into a little nuance then here, if we could. The president says oil companies can afford to live without subsidies from the government that they get. Oil company defenders say, you know what, we got to keep drilling with prices so high.
Mm-hmm.
Where does reality lie?
All right, a quick 5 seconds of history here.
All right.
One of the subsidies goes back to the dawn of the U.S. tax code in 1916. And back then, the government was all about drilling to promote car ownership, the Industrial Revolution. Well, okay, we've had our revolution. And now the White House says, okay, let's kill the subsidies. But that gets in the way of another White House priority, and that is more domestic energy sources. See, if you take away tax incentives to drill, you get less drilling, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the industry argues, yes, we have to drill because gas prices are so high. Except that it takes 5 or 7 years for a company project to actually put gas in your tank. So, yes, more U.S. supply could moderate prices, but not tomorrow, maybe 2016.
Well, speaking of tomorrow, what is going to happen? I mean, they're going to have these hearings and Congress will chew it over, and then what?
Well, we could have senators throw a bipartisan tantrum and then everybody goes home. That's happened before in Washington. But what's different this year is the laser focus on the budget and finding ways to end tax breaks, loopholes, corporate welfare, whatever you want to call it. And these oil industry provisions get you $2 billion a year. Now, the issue may not be ripe today or tomorrow, but analyst Kevin Book thinks over the next year, the chances are pretty decent.
So when you get to next year, if prices are still high, you'll have the same drivers in the same cars with less cash and less credit looking at the same politicians and asking, what have you done for me lately?
Now, Kai, in the last few years, Congress has pared back a couple oil sector tax breaks, so it has happened before.
This comes in the category of tax expenditures for those keeping track in your federal budget debate handbook. Marketplace's Scott Tong with a quick preview of the oil subsidy hearings in Congress tomorrow. Scott, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Here's the quirk about American energy policy, though, most specifically the part about oil. It's one big global marketplace, so we're not isolated from what's happening elsewhere. Domestic affairs in other countries play a big part in oil prices and in our debate over what to do here. Expand exploration in places like Alaska or invest more in offshore oil drilling. Case in point, Canada. Our neighbor to the north is our number one source of crude. And so commentator David Frum says Canada's recent election is good news for us.
The United States cannot drill its way to energy independence, but Canada can. While the U.S. landmass is relatively poor in oil resources, it's estimated that the Canadian province of Alberta contains more fuel energy than all of Saudi Arabia. Alberta's oil is mixed with sand, a fact that until recently pushed its cost prohibitively high. But improving technology and rising global oil prices have burst the old constraints. Canada has surged into first place among U.S. oil suppliers. Good news for Americans concerned about where their oil comes from and how oil dollars are used. For Canada also ranks first among world purchasers of American products. Environmental concerns are real, especially the greenhouse gas emissions associated with extraction. But the industry has made great progress reducing water pollution, to the point where the Royal Society of Canada has determined that oil sands development is not a threat to aquatic ecosystems. Yet Alberta oil faces one remaining economic challenge: its location. Alberta is about as far from open water as it gets in North America. So Alberta oil must move by pipeline. One existing pipeline already carries about 600,000 barrels of oil per day. A proposal has been advanced to expand capacity to nearly 1.3 million barrels a day, one-seventh of all U.S. consumption. Canada has approved it. On May 2nd, Canadians emphatically re-elected the most pro-pipeline party as their government for the next 4 years. The next decision rests with the Obama administration, and has rested and rested and rested. On the plus side, secure oil, a responsible producer, no risks of oil spills at sea. On the negative side, well, it's still oil. And some people think we shouldn't be burning it at all. Fair point, and maybe someday we won't. But for now, the question is not, shall we buy oil? The question is, from where? It should be an easy call. Why is it taking so long?
David Frum was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Today he's the editor of Frum Forum. Coming up next week in this space, Robert Reich, your views whenever you like. Send us your comments online is best. Marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, new ways to do medicine in New Orleans.
It makes you find those patients to bring them back in the clinic when they don't follow up so that they don't end up in the emergency room or an expensive part of the healthcare system.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street, you might say, hit an oil slick today. The Dow Industrials gave back 130 points, 1%, closed at 12,630. The NASDAQ forfeited 26 points, 0.9%, 28.45. The Bell and the S&P 500 shed 15 points, 1%, finished up at 13.42. Crude prices fell below the $100 a barrel mark after reports that oil supplies are climbing. Energy shares sank and brought a lot of the market down with them. Marathon Oil spilled 3%. ExxonMobil slipped 0.2%. Chevron poured off 2% today. But nothing could rain on Macy's parade. Shares in the retailer soared more than 7.5% today after it reported higher than expected quarterly profits. Nordstrom restocked nearly 1%. JCPenney rang up 0.2% today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.16%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department is scheduled to release retail sales data for the month of April. More than 100 police officers from around the country will jump on some hogs for the first annual Blue Valor Run. The 260-mile motorcycle ride starts at Ground Zero and honors officers who have died in the line of duty. And baseball great Yogi Berra turns 86. I'm Preeti Upadhyay.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We had one of those screwy economic indicators this morning, the kind that seems lousy on the surface, but then you dig a little bit deeper. The Commerce Department said the trade deficit rose 6% in March. Nobody likes a rising trade gap. It means we're sending more money out of the country to buy stuff than the rest of the world is spending to buy our exports. Thing is, U.S. exports are actually rising right now. They're rising a lot, but so are prices for some of the raw materials that help fuel our economy. Yeah, that'd be oil. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
I started tracking this story right downstairs at the Pony Espresso truck where I get my midday latte. What are you paying for coffee?
$193 now for 20 pounds. At the beginning of the year, it was like $158, something like that.
Not only is imported coffee up, so's fuel, says Bruce Lindner. He's owner, driver, barista.
Extra $10 every day in gas, which I have not passed on to the customer.
Good for my budget, but not for Lindner or other U.S. businesses. That's the import side of the equation. On the other side, U.S. exports were up the most in 17 years in March. And it's across the board, autos, chemicals, machinery, and also...
For our product, fresh cherries, it is up.
That's John Bailey with Orchard View Farms in Oregon, which produces a lot of cherries. And every year, more of them are picked and loaded onto planes.
China is our biggest market. Second would be the UK or Korea, Australia, Japan, all those are pretty close. It actually looks very, very good.
Now, flying fresh cherries to all those countries will cost more this year. Think aviation fuel. More than balancing that is the incredibly weak U.S. dollar, which makes cherries and tractors and software cheaper for foreign customers. The danger, if oil prices keep climbing, we'll be sending more money offshore to pay for it, pushing the trade deficit even higher. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Okay, your turn.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
The story on the broadcast that got the most comments over the past week, by far, was one that went in search of the answer to this question. Can organic farming feed the world? We took as our point of departure a report from the British government that said, no, organic agriculture by itself can't do it. Chemical fertilizers and, yes, genetically modified crops, GMOs, they're called sometimes, are going to have to be used as well. And that's when the email started, most in defense of organics, like this one from David Robinson of Denver.
Sustainable organic farming creates jobs, produces better quality food, reduces the need for shipping food long distances, reduces the dependence on oil, has no need for chemical herbicides, pesticides, and fertilizers, returns more prosperity to local economies, and contributes more to overall health.
Amanda Heyman of Minneapolis wrote to detail some of the drawbacks of GMOs, farmers having to buy new seeds every year, herbicides building up in waterways.
What is actually needed is funding for localized crop breeding, which will produce seeds best suited for particular environments. Those seeds will have the best shot at weathering climate change and feeding the world, not GMO seeds.
Not everybody was critical, though. Tyler Martikainen-Watke of Reading, Pennsylvania, said the shift from subsistence farming to agribusiness has been a boon overall.
I agree we need to move away from petroleum-based fertilizers, but I fear the compost and mine nitrates will not be enough. Instead, I think scientists will come up with a GM solution. It's a low labor input required in conventional farming that has allowed many to move away from the farm and let America to prosper.
One last thought about that story. No small number of the emails about it, about a third of them or so, said we ran it just because we used to get underwriting support from Monsanto. That support ended more than a year ago. Just for the record, underwriters have no say at all in what goes on the radio. There's an editor's note on our website explaining why we actually did run the piece. It's marketplace.org. Waters are rising along the southern stretches of the Mississippi River today. Crews are shoring up levees in Baton Rouge in New Orleans. They've got no desire for a repeat of the flooding from 5 years ago and Hurricane Katrina. But that storm is still helping reshape the city of New Orleans. Healthcare, in this instance. Before Katrina, the only way a lot of people there saw a doctor was to go to the public hospital emergency room, with taxpayers often picking up the tab. But when Katrina wrecked all the public hospitals there, the city decided to start over. Mary Stuckey reports now on healthcare reform, New Orleans style.
It's a typical day at this red brick clinic near New Orleans French Quarter. A steady flow of patients comes in for routine tests, counseling, and the usual colds and flu.
Are you diabetic?
No, I have blood pressure.
Okay.
What's not so typical is the clinic itself, or at least it wasn't before Katrina. It's what's known as a medical home, a place where local, usually poor residents can get most of the care they need right in the neighborhood. The care is coordinated, so patients see the same doctor every time. A caseworker keeps track of medications and appointments. The clinics have extended hours. Austin Duskin Sr. is a patient at the clinic near the French Quarter. Duskin says he's relieved to finally have a regular doctor who takes time to discuss his overall health and to explain the chronic pain in his hip.
I told him about it, and he explained that the cartridge is gone. He talked to me about changing my diet and try to eat more healthy.
Before Hurricane Katrina, Duskin and many other residents of New Orleans went without a regular doctor. They typically got the treatment they needed at the emergency room. But now, using a $100 million federal grant, the city has rebuilt its health care system along the medical home model. There are 93 across New Orleans. Dr. Karen DeSalvo is New Orleans Commissioner of Health. She says this team model allows individual staff members to work at what she calls the top of their license. Primary care doctors, for instance, aren't doubling as social workers at physicians' rates.
It makes the system a lot less doctor heavy. So it makes us then work as a team. And then it makes you find those patients to bring them back in the clinic when they don't follow up so that they don't end up in the emergency room or an expensive part of the healthcare system.
New Orleans has some of the highest rates in the nation for obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and asthma. All diseases that can best be managed with regular attention. The medical homes have saved taxpayers millions of dollars, according to DeSalvo. Whether patients are healthier is being studied. But New Orleans doctor Ebony Price Haywood thinks they are.
We have a diabetes care management program, and I can tell you that within our clinic, patients who have participated in those programs are the ones who have shown rapid improvement in their disease management.
A Kaiser Family Foundation study found that 20% more of the uninsured in New Orleans now have routine medical care. Again, Dr. Price Haywood.
I think with the medical home structure that we've built in New Orleans, that has been the primary focus, is not only to treat but also to prevent.
Price Haywood thinks New Orleans can be a model for other parts of the country, and she says it should not have to take a hurricane. In New Orleans, I'm Mary Stuckey for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, you could call it a branding failure or slogan unawareness or just plain a slip-up, but I think somebody forgot to tell Newt Gingrich that the political stump speech use of the phrase "win the future" is already taken. The White House rolled it out for the State of the Union. But today on his website, newt.org, as he officially announces that he's running for president, there's a quote from the former speaker himself saying, "Together, we will win the future." Or maybe he just wants to replace Joe Biden in 2012. I don't know. Anyway, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow gave back 130 points, about 1%. The NASDAQ gave back 26 points, 9/10%. The S&P 500 was off 15 points, about 1 1/10%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back here, what's in a name? Well, if you're talking drug names, lots of consonants.
It's getting to be a little bit like the Slovak language, difficult to pronounce, difficult to deal with.
The big business of naming drugs. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.